welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And we stream live at those times here on this station. But I want to let you know something, a little secret, that you might want to check out the podcasts on SoundCloud and iTunes or go to the radio show's page of richarddugan.com. Because sometimes these interviews, they go long. I mean, the radio program is only 50 minutes long. But based upon the availability of our guests, sometimes we go another 10 or 20 or 30 minutes, and there's all kinds of great stuff in that 10 or 20 or 30 minutes you don't want to miss. So please avail yourselves of that and go there. We would encourage you to do that. We don't want you to miss anything. We also want you to click on the link to our guest's website. And, of course, we give that out in every program. We'll give out the website to our guest here shortly as well. So we encourage you to go there to continue your research, your education, edification, entertainment, inspiration, or I even like to say your evolution. All right, we're going to talk a little bit about something along those lines as well today. And also a reminder that if you'd like to support this broadcast, we have a podcast, a PayPal link on the homepage, but we also have it on the missions page where it also talks about what this radio program is all about. If you've been listening to these interviews and haven't figured it out yet, then go to the mission page and read about what we're doing. And if you'd like to be a part of it, we're grateful for any support that you can give us. We are not a nonprofit, so it's you're just supporting what we're doing. It's not a contribution or a donation. You're just supporting what we're doing, and we are greatly appreciative of that. All right, let's talk a little bit. I was going to start this program with my special guest here on the program like this. I'd like all of you to turn in your hymnals to page 27 and sing along with me, because today we're going to talk about spiritual science. Are you serious? Spiritual science, why science needs spirituality to make sense of the world. Steve Taylor is my guest. He's the best-selling author of The Leap. We've had him on before. Steve, thank you so much for joining us all the way from the UK.
Hi, Richard. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
I find this interesting. We're hearing this more and more, and of course, I've been reading, of course, from for decades, the ancient wisdom teachings from around the world, going back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. That science and spirituality, although I'm not sure they called it science way back when or back in the day, as they say, there was no separation. Life just was life. When I take a look at nature, for example, and, you know, we talk about the predator and the prey, and I say, well, that's man's judgment on the animal kingdom, that predator and prey thing. For them, that's just life, okay? So spirituality and science, to me, just like the various systems of the human body, they're inseparable, and you can't separate them. You can't compartmentalize them. I argue with my ophthalmologist about, for example, my eye pressure, for example. And she refuses to acknowledge that my blood pressure has an impact on my eye pressure. The systems are connected. So let's talk about this. Could we say it's a symbiotic relationship in our modern day between science and spirituality?
Well, I think there should be a symbiotic relationship. But, you know, as you suggest, in the modern world, there is this kind of schism. You know, science and spirituality are seen as opposites almost. A lot of scientists, you know, they're completely opposed to anything spiritual. You know, they hear the word spiritual and their blood begins to boil straight away because they think of it's they think it's unscientific. And it's a false opposition. I mean, science and spirituality are really just two slightly different ways of understanding the world or trying to understand the world. You know, science is based on observation. It's basically a system of observing and theorizing about the world. And in a sense, so is spirituality. Spirituality is about sort of looking inwardly and observing your own inner life. So, you know, science is kind of more externally based. Spirituality is internally based, but those two things are complementary. You know, you have to have both of them in order to, you know, gain a clear understanding of the world.
An inner world and an outer world, as it were. And there's a phrase, I'm not exactly sure exactly where it's from, but as above, so below, as below, so above. or as inside, outside, and vice versa. I mean, even when I was taking science classes, biology classes, and so forth in school, and they would show you whether it was a diagram or they actually had a model on the desktop of a molecule. And you had the protons, electrons, neutrons spinning around a nucleus and then, you know, the subatomic particles and so on and so forth. And, of course, I'm looking at this going, gee, you know, that looks an awful lot like a solar system in the galaxy. And I'm thinking, so why is this stuff so hard to figure out? Because we've done a pretty darn good job of figuring out our own biology and looking through a microscope. So why would it be so different looking through the telescope out into the universe and realizing that there's a connection there, and it makes sense to me that there would be.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you go down right down to the, you know, the most microscopic particles of matter into the subatomic realm, then everything becomes very spiritual, you know. And I think a lot of scientists presume that in the kind of external world that we live in, and the normal everyday world that we operate in every day of our lives, they assume it's a kind of machine-like thing. You know, it operates according to physical laws, and it's made up of these particles which collect together and interact with each other. And we're all just sort of genetic machines bumping into each other. Everything is just material particles operating according to physical laws. That's kind of like the standard materialistic view of science. But if you go right down into, you know, inside matter, into subatomic particles, then everything becomes very strange and very spiritual, very mysterious. You know, so I'm talking about, obviously, I'm talking about quantum physics. At the quantum level, everything is interconnected. Matter doesn't really exist as a solid thing. It kind of dissolves into nothingness and then arises again. And once two particles have interacted with each other, they're forever connected. They always behave as if they are part of one greater entity. And in a sense, the whole universe is one entity. So everything is interconnected. And every single particle in the universe is connected with every other particle. And these kind of spiritual wave-like formations spread everywhere. So at that level, you know, there is really no distinction between spirituality and science. You know, science is completely spiritual.
I often joked with people when I worked for the Christian radio station back in Phoenix in the 80s and 90s, when I was questioned about whether I believed in creationism versus evolution, I says, well, I believe in evolution because God created evolution. You know, I mean, come on. If God created everything, he created evolution too. And then I take it to the next level saying, why do you send your children to school? Well, to get an education. What's happening there? Well, they're getting an education. They're broadening the horizons. I said, well, there's another word you can use for that. They're evolving. Oh, my God, they're involved in a process called evolution in our educational system. We've got to pull them out because—and I'm just like, you know, let's wake up. I remember the first time I debated someone regarding the word metaphysics. I says, Christianity is a metaphysical philosophy. Because it has nothing. It's not about the external world. It's about the internal world, about the non-physical world. And that's kind of what science and spirituality are. One deals with, as you said, not just the inner world, but the non-tactile, non-physical world. And science deals more so with the physical material world. However, let's talk a little bit about how now science is beginning to support, if you will, or maybe show evidence of that non-physical or metaphysical world.
Yeah, that's an interesting development because it's becoming more and more apparent that the standard model of science is actually wrong. It doesn't work very well. It doesn't actually explain the world. So the standard model of materialistic science is a very poor explanatory tool. It can't explain things like consciousness. It can't explain altruism, you know, why human beings act kindly and generously towards each other. It can't explain things like the placebo effect, the influence of the mind over the body, the way that the mind could sometimes have a healing effect on the body. And even evolution, I don't think it can explain evolution either. And that's becoming more and more apparent. And I think it's quite common now for scientists to begin to investigate more spiritual perspectives, like panpsychism, which is the idea that every particle of matter has a degree of consciousness. And there's a philosophy I call panspiritism, which is the idea that consciousness is a fundamental quality in the universe. It's actually kind of embedded, ingrained into the fabric of reality. And if you establish that as the main kind of underlying principle of science, that consciousness is a universal fundamental quality, then you can begin to understand the world a lot better. Then a lot of the puzzles that I've mentioned, like consciousness, altruism, the influence of the mind over the body, then these puzzles become more explainable. In fact, you can explain them pretty easily from that perspective.
Well, that's one of the other things, too. I loved what James Redfield says in the Celestine Prophecy about how we have messages for one another, and that we're trying to build our own individual puzzle to understand our place in the universe. And then when we don't share, when we put up the shields, I like to use the Star Trek metaphor, put up the shields, yeah, we can fire weapons, you know, but we can't transport in and out. We can't get information in the same way that we would if the shields were down. And then we can't better understand ourselves and help others to understand themselves. And I'm going to be, I'll tell you what, I'll tell our listeners right now, I'm not saying that neither Steve nor I have all the answers or what have you. It's up to you to make that decision. You've got to evaluate it. Let's talk a little bit about that in terms of the information that's out there. And I've used this analogy in regards to science, that the scientific world over the centuries basically discovers one of the laws of the universe. And so, oh, okay, we've discovered seven, and we know it all now. And then the following decade, we discover number eight. Ah, now we really know it all. And this happens over and over and over again because, for example, physics. Okay, I'm just trying to understand what physics really is and what it encompasses and all of this stuff. Then along comes quantum physics. I'm going, what? What the heck? Well, and so what's the big difference between physics and quantum physics? And I'm waiting for the next shoe to drop, and we're not going to call it physics. We're going to call it Google-mania or something. You know, it's the next level beyond quantum physics. And even with spirituality, when you start talking about that, those who are firm believers, regardless of what the philosophy is, they will say, hey, you know, they found evidence of thus and such that's written about in the great writings of my philosophy that supports and makes my philosophy true. It's like, well, but then yours is no longer a faith-based philosophy. Now it's a fact-based philosophy. And, you know, that's very interesting to look at those kinds of things. But what about that in terms of parsing the information, whether it be in spirituality or science, in terms of, I don't want to say coming to a conclusion, because I don't think that there is one. There is no end game, so to speak. It's a continuum. It's a continuous evolutionary process, regardless of how long we're on the planet. And I don't know if I'm wrong about that or not, but can you share a little bit about that?
Well, I agree with you. I think there is a tendency for human beings to think, yeah, we've got the truth. You know, we understand everything now. Or at least they have the desire to do that and the feeling that they are close to that. I think that was quite common in science maybe 20 years ago. Some scientists were talking about the end of science, you know, the point where we would understand all of the big questions. We would solve all of the riddles of the world and human behavior. We would understand how genes create human behavior. We would understand how life originated and how life forms evolved and so on. But that was a foolish assumption, because it quickly became evident that there are so many things we don't understand. And the more you understand, the more you realize that you don't understand. The more kind of answers you uncover, the more questions arise. So we're at that point now where a lot of scientists are beginning to realize that it's too complex for us to understand. The universe is too mysterious for us to understand. Dark matter or dark energy, 97% of the universe consists of dark matter, but nobody really knows what it actually is, or what its function is. So that's extremely materialist, extremely mysterious. And consciousness is also extremely mysterious. Nobody's got the slightest inkling of how the brain may be associated with consciousness. So I think it's become more evident that we don't know the answers. But that's a great feeling. It's a great feeling, I think, to feel that we're in this mysterious, magical universe where we're actually not able to understand it. It's beyond our comprehension. Maybe, you know, in thousands of years, there will be living beings who are more conscious than us, who have bigger brains and have a greater awareness of reality. And they'll probably understand more about the universe. They will be able to answer more of the big riddles of the world and human behavior. But even they, you know, they won't know the full story. And maybe, you know, maybe nobody ever will. Maybe it will always remain mysterious, which is fine with me.
I often was because I was always asking questions. Gee, I wonder why I'm doing this. I was always asking questions, and someone came up to me. I think it was in my early 20s, and they said, "You know, you need to leave some of those questions unanswered for something to do in the next life. You know, in the next lifetime." I actually jokingly say when someone prominent who has promoted a particular philosophy passes. Especially in relation to many of the televangelists who passed away here in the United States over the 80s and 90s, then they start dropping off. And I remember one of them who dropped off, and I said, "Well, at least now he knows the truth." Well, that's an assumption on my part that in the next life, whatever that is, we get to know the answers to all of the questions that we've been asking in this life. But see, to me, that's part of the reason why we're doing this program is because we're trying to, you know, find out, well, what does Steve know that maybe I can incorporate into my philosophy that fits, that makes, from my perspective, rational and logical sense, not just because Steve said it because I like the cut of his jib or, you know, he believes in a particular thing and I do too. And so I'm just going to accept what he says. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that's the issue I have with a lot of religious people, particularly fundamentalist religious people. Mm-hmm. They feel that they have the truth and they know all the answers. And you can understand how that's quite a good feeling to, you know, to have that sense that you understand the world and you know your place in the world. You know what you got to do in this life. But it's very rigid as well. It's very rigid. And it closes you off to so much, you know, feeling that you have the truth closes you off to so many experiences and it closes you off to so much of the mystery of the world. But I mean, ironically, a lot of scientists like that too. A lot of scientists believe in this materialistic model of the world, you know, the idea that only matter exists and everything can be explained in terms of matter. But that's also a belief system. It's, you know, a way of closing yourself off to reality. You know, a way of enclosing yourself within this very rigid view of the world. So that's, you know, in a sense, they're not so different from religious people.
Yeah, I would say that's true, too. But what I found fascinating, too, as I take a look at the various prominent scientists down through history, and especially in the last century, I mean, they talk about Einstein, for example. He was a believer in the fact that there was a higher power, that there was a God. I don't know what his philosophy was, if he was a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, Buddhist, followed Shintoism, et cetera, et cetera. But he did acknowledge the fact, if I'm correct, there is something bigger than all of us that made all of this, and we're just trying to understand it. And I guess the biggest question of all that a lot of people, both scientists and spiritualists or people who are in various philosophies, are always asking, especially when it comes to evolution and, of course, people promote the Big Bang. I mean, even I ask the question, I say, okay, great, I get the Big Bang, I get the concept, but you can't make something from nothing. Where did the material come from that exploded? Mm. You know, either that or this goes maybe back to what we referred to earlier. There's a law of the universe we just don't understand yet that would allow for there to be something created from maybe something that was jettisoned from another dimension. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we just don't know. I mean, and then again, how relevant is that question? How does knowing how the Big Bang was created change your life today?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it reminds me of the Buddha. You know, in Buddhism, in Buddhist texts, a lot of Buddha's followers would ask him, you know, deep metaphysical questions like, you know, what does nirvana mean? Does it mean that we live after death, or does it mean that we are extinguished? Or they would say to the Buddha, you know, can animals become enlightened? Things like that. And the Buddha would say, you know, I'm not answering these questions because they're not relevant. He would say, the only thing that's relevant is to relieve suffering in your life. And he used the metaphor of the a soldier. If you were walking along a path one day and you found a soldier lying there with an arrow stuck in his body, bleeding to death, you wouldn't stand around and say, where does this arrow come from? What's it made of? You wouldn't bother with questions like that. All you do is try to remove the arrow. So the Buddha said, you know, my teachings are like that. I'm trying to remove the arrow of human suffering. Yeah. So I don't care about metaphysical questions.
Yeah.
And you can understand that. In some ways, it's a very practical philosophy, you know.
Yeah. I also like the Buddha in terms of how he came to become the Buddha. You know, he was searching for enlightenment, and he was searching and searching and searching and searching. And it wasn't until he sat down below the Bodhi tree, at the base of the Bodhi tree, and he realized, oh, if I stop searching, I'll have it, which is a paradox that man and his intellect can't quite comprehend. It's akin to when I was a teenager and actually in my early 20s, and I was looking for companionship. I was looking for, you know, a girlfriend, you know. And I had a lot of good friends who kept saying, you know, you're coming off desperate. And they don't like that. In other words, I was looking and looking and looking. And as soon as I stopped looking, boom, what happened? And, of course, there you go. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, you got to be, it says in Taoism, in the Tao Te Ching, it says, it said you should be as flexible as a child's mind and a child's body. So the kind of, you know, this kind of flexibility that children have in terms of their minds and also their bodies, we have to cultivate that as adults.
Yeah.
So that we're never rigid. You know, if you search for enlightenment in a very rigid, determined, egotistical way, you're going to push it away. You know, it's going to be counterproductive. But if you relax, if you're flexible, if you're open to whatever emerges, and if you accept whatever emerges, then, you know, you're much more likely to achieve enlightenment.
You've seen little kids, or they're running around on the playground and they bump their knee on something. They grab the knee, they cry for a couple of minutes, then all of a sudden their attention gets distracted from that to something else. They stop their crying and they go off and they play some more. They don't spend a lot of time there. I mean, unless it's really serious, but I mean, that's kind of the mind of a child. And even Jesus in the Christian teachings says basically that we need to come as little children, not childish, childlike.
Yeah, I think that's maybe what Jesus meant. You know, Jesus did have some very profound spiritual teachings. I think that was one of them, that just like the Tao Te Ching says, you need to cultivate that childlike sense of openness and
wonder. And wonder.
Yeah, that the childlike vision, you know, the vision of, that children have, that kind of natural wakefulness they have, the really intense perception and that sense of connectedness, you know. Yeah, we lose that as we become adults. So
yeah,
part of spiritual awakening is to recapture that.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to encourage with our program, and encouraging people to seek out not new life and new civilizations, but new paradigms for a new world, so that we can start thriving. I'm curious as to where you hail from philosophically, in terms of maybe your upbringing and then how that's transformed to today.
Well, my upbringing was very secular. My parents weren't religious, but they weren't atheists either. They just weren't really interested in religion or God. They never talked about it. Mm-hmm. My father was just obsessed with sport. He was a big soccer fan. So you could say that was our religion. Soccer was my religion. And but when I was a teenager, I started to have what I now realize was spiritual experiences, you know, feelings of connection to my surroundings, feelings of inner ecstasy, feelings that my surroundings would become incredibly alive, and there was a sense of harmony and meaning everywhere. At first, I didn't understand those experiences, and I felt a bit confused. But years later, when I began to read spiritual books, when I began to read about mysticism and mystical experiences, I realized that I'd been having those experiences. So suddenly, you know, things began to make sense. So I was always interested in those experiences, and I eventually got involved in psychology. I did like a master's degree in psychology and a PhD in psychology, mainly because I wanted to understand these experiences. I wanted to study them and to find out how common they were and what were the kind of psychological conditions which gave rise to them. And I wanted to look into the after effects of the experiences too. Mm-hmm. But mostly I was interested in how these experiences are generated and if they can become permanent. You know, can spiritual awakening become a permanent state? And how is spiritual awakening, how does it arise? You know, are there special conditions which give rise to it? So that's basically what I've been doing over the last few years in my research as a psychologist.
It's interesting to take a look at the library that you have created. Obviously, today we're focusing primarily on spiritual science, that particular work that you have now. But you have you have a total of 10 books out, maybe more, that aren't listed on the website. The Fall, Making Time. There's one I'd love to get into, because the more time goes by, I'm 58, and it seems like the days, the weeks, the months, the years are going faster and faster. It was only yesterday that I was desperately seeking companionship. Okay, it was only yesterday that I read Autobiography of a Yogi for the very first time when I was 17. It was only yesterday that I traveled to Ireland twice, and I never expected to do that. It was only yesterday that I experienced the loss of a loved one, a pet, a dear, dear pet. And to that end, I wanted to share with our listeners that as of this program, my dear companion and partner in crime, so to speak, animal partner, Makushla, we set her free on the 12th of October, 2018, after her service, great service as a caregiver. And it was only on the 11th of October that I realized that was the main reason why we actually, why she came into our lives in the first place, because we had an elderly Siberian Husky whose family of a total of four, we had to put down three of them over the course of 3 years. And he was just mourning like I've never ever seen an animal do. And if anybody says that animals don't have souls, I'll argue till the cows come home that they do. Mm. They know and they miss. And so she was there for him until his end in 2007, then continued to raise one of our other dogs until that dog was bitten by a rattlesnake and died, and then raised our current dog from the age of 8 weeks until his present age of six. She's no longer with us in physical form, but I have been told by some animal channelers that because we freed her, she now can do more work and service for us and with us than she could in that body of hers where the hips gave out and she couldn't walk without any assistance and so forth. So just letting people know, because I've talked about her on the program many times. Beautiful, all white shepherd husky mix, all white. And I'm going to miss her a lot. But 16 and a half, I believe, was how old she was when we set her free. And that's how I look at it. We didn't put her down. We didn't put her to sleep. We set her free because it's that essence within us, you and me. Steve, I don't know even where that – I don't know what – that is that consciousness? And if that's the consciousness that we're talking about, where does it reside in the physical body? Can you answer that question?
Oh, I'll try.
Okay. Give it a shot before we go to break. And you've got plenty of time. Don't worry. Shot. Don't worry about the break.
Okay. Well, I think, consciousness or spirit is a fundamental thing in the universe. It's everywhere. And I think the universe actually arises from spirit. Spirit exists before the universe. But when you get like creatures with brains developing, like dogs or human beings, the purpose of the brain isn't to produce consciousness, but the brain actually sort of channels consciousness into our individual bodies. The brain acts like a kind of receiver and a transmitter of consciousness. It picks up consciousness, which is in the air around us, and it becomes canalized or channeled into our own body. And so it exists everywhere in the body. It exists in the brain, because that's kind of like the primary receiver of consciousness, the brain. That's where most of our neurons are, but we also have neurons in other parts of the body, such as the stomach. But, you know, so in a sense, it's everywhere in the body, but primarily in the area of the brain. But it's not, it doesn't just belong to us, it belongs to everything. Consciousness belongs to every living thing, and even all material, even seemingly non-living material things. It belongs to the air around us, the space around us. So we share it, and it pervades every single thing in the universe.
You know, I pose this question to people especially when they start getting especially very materialistic, not so much in terms of gathering stuff, but materialistic from the standpoint of supporting a particular ideology, especially when it comes to, say, democracy, liberty, and freedom. Okay. So then I go to the micro level, and I'd love your input on this as well. And we'll get to that following the break. But here's the concept. The question is, under what ism, what system of government do the cells of the body function under? Now, the first one you have to eliminate is democracy. Because if each individual cell of the trillions of cells that exist decided one day, and again, using your comments about consciousness, they all have their individual consciousness and said, I want to do my own thing. I'm going over here. The body would cease to exist. So it's not democracy under which that system works, the cells of the body function. I don't know that I could even use any constructs that we even know of to describe it, because, you know, I mean, you could say, well, what about socialism? What about communism? What about any of the other human isms that we've seen developed over the centuries on the planet? I mean, I'm not even sure what the system is. And I label it as interdependentism. Your thoughts,
yeah,
sir?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's cooperation. There used to be, and still is in some quarters, this idea that everything's competitive, that the cells are competitive, the genes inside the cells are competitive. You know, this idea of the selfish genes that are kind of fighting for survival and competing with one another. And this idea that living beings are in competition, that the life is a survival of the fittest. We're all in this competition for resources. But everyone knows now that that's not true. Life depends on cooperation. Genes work in cooperation with each other. Living beings, you know, mostly we live in groups where we have to cooperate to survive. And we live on a planet where, you know, it's becoming more and more evident that we can only survive through cooperation. And a lot of biologists now think that life began through cooperation, that the simple cells which began life on Earth, they evolved cooperatively rather than sort of competitively. Mm-hmm. So everything is cooperation. You know, I think that down to the level of genes, down to cells, down to a global level, or up to a global level.
I mean, you even take it down to the subatomic. You get the electrons, neutrons, and protons spinning around the nucleus, and each one of those says, I want to do my own thing. Gee, what do you think is going to happen to that cell? Well, it deteriorates, and it, you know, doesn't exist anymore. Although there would be those who would say, well, yeah, but what about cancer cells? Well, I have a feeling that they also function in the same fashion, but maybe for a different reason. Maybe there's, again, maybe it's another one of those laws of the universe we haven't discovered yet, that we don't quite understand why that happens. Maybe we're doing it to ourselves. There are those who do believe that a lot of our dis-ease, man, not a lot of, all of our dis-ease, we do it to ourselves. What we're going to do to ourselves right now is take a break. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Steve Taylor. He's the author of the latest work, Spiritual Science, Why Science Needs Spirituality to Make Sense of the World. We cannot compartmentalize this stuff, folks. We really can't. But we are going to compartmentalize this break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tell me your story.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Steve Taylor, author of Spiritual Science, Why Science Needs Spirituality to Make Sense of the World. And I'm going to guess, Steve, you could have phrased that the other way too, why spirituality needs science to make sense of the world. I mean, you get to put it in one order or another, you know, and there you go. I want to talk a little bit about another subject here. I joke with people saying that when we have folks on the program, we never ask them stuff they don't know anything about. So I'm not going to ask anything about nuclear physics. I want to ask you about I want to ask you about this concept that you created in one of your other works, Humania.
Oh, yeah.
Define that puppy for us, would you please? There's another phrase that you use, but it would sort of give it away. Tell us what Humania is.
Yeah, Humania is the basic madness of the human mind, which is so normal to us that we don't even realize it's there. But if you look at the way that our species operates collectively, you know, with all the madness of warfare, the madness of inequality and the radical conflicts between different sections of society, if you look at that, and then if you look at the way we live individually, with the madness of trying to acquire more and more possessions, the madness of trying to acquire as much power as possible, the madness of competing against one another, and the madness of filling our days with endless activity because we can't do nothing. It's all a kind of madness. And, like I say, it's so normal to us that we take it for granted. But I always think that if you were an alien anthropologist and you came to Earth from a different planet to observe the human race, you would conclude that we are mad, that we suffer from a psychological disorder. And that's what I call Humania.
Well, it certainly is. I have to tell you that I'm trying to, I've been looking for medication for it, but I haven't found anything yet that will cure it. Maybe it's because it's not curable.
Meditation's a good, medication.
Okay.
Meditation.
I like that. And you prescribe this, you have a PhD or a doctor that you can prescribe this for me now?
I am a doctor, so I can give you a prescription. I'll give you a daily dose of meditation. Another daily dose of contact with nature. Also, a dose of altruism, regular altruistic activity. And, if you stick to that for a few days, for a few weeks, you'll begin to transcend your Humania.
Now, what I find interesting about this is that I heard this comment the other day, and it really frustrated me when I heard this, because what it does is it says that we don't have any control. The reason why this was the commentary that was made. The reason why we have the laws that we do in this world down through the centuries is because human nature says that we're not going to behave ourselves, so we need these laws to keep us in line. The only problem with that logic, from my perspective, is we have the laws in place and we're still doing those things that are in violation thereof. I mean, from not only killing one another and hurting one another, but something very mundane to some folks would be, I was taking my walk this morning down the main street of Santa Barbara. People are crossing the street anytime they want, any place they want, against the red light. Bicyclers fly through the red light. Fortunately, not many cars are doing that. And of course, I even want to stop the pedestrians and the cyclists saying, "Do you own a car?" "Yes, I do." Would you run that red light with your car like you walked through it or bicycled through it? And odds are they'd say, "Well, no, I'd get a ticket." Do you know that you can still get a ticket for walking through a red light and bicycling through a red light? You know, it's like the phrase, "Well, I'm only human." just it's like a cop out from my perspective. It's like I'm only human. I have no control over my own bodily functions of walking across against a red light. I'm curious as to what the judge will say. Your Honor, I neither plead innocent nor guilty. I plead I'm only human. Okay, case dismissed. I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
Talk to us about the relationship between being only human, or in some philosophies like Christianity, the devil, if Flip Wilson and the devil made me do it, to, you know what, I'm 100% responsible for the life that either A, I created, or B, I've been given, but I'm still responsible for my life.
Well, human nature is very flexible, and it, you know, it's human beings can be the most evil psychopaths, but we can also be saints. We can all be the most saintly, perfect, and altruistic individuals. And there's a lot of space between those two extremes. And it kind of varies from day to day. You know, sometimes we behave altruistically. You can be altruistic in the morning. You can be selfish in the evening, depending on your mood or depending on what situation you're in. So I think when human beings are kind of, when we're veering towards the altruistic side of the spectrum, then, you know, we can regulate our own behavior. We don't really need laws because we behave, we have our own sort of inner law, which is based on empathy and compassion and responsibility. But when we veer towards the other side of the spectrum and, you know, we allow our kind of more selfish instincts to express themselves, then, you know, I think you do need some kind of laws just to curtail that, just to control that selfishness. So, you know, I think, you know, what maybe one day when human beings are more orientated towards the positive side of the spectrum, when we're more altruistic, less selfish, then maybe, you know, maybe laws will be unnecessary. But, you know, for the time being, I think some control, some kind of external controls are probably necessary.
You know, I read this story about a small town in the Midwest that was having serious problems with people running the red light. No, I take that. Yeah, it was a red light. I was going to say stop sign, but it was a red light. And they had these problems. And in any event, they had traffic control. And they tried everything, cameras with tickets following and on and on and on. And they finally came to this conclusion. None of the traffic control devices we've installed have worked. None of the public service announcements, commercials, signs, and all the other stuff that we've tried to do to get people to stop running have worked. So this is the solution they came up with. And this addresses what you're talking about. They took out all traffic control devices. And nobody ran through that intersection again. Because you didn't know who was coming from the opposite, from the perpendicular direction. So you'd slow down, and in some cases you would stop. Because if you didn't, boom. Now, I find that to be a very interesting solution. And there's a part of me that says, okay, let's take out all traffic control devices in the city of Los Angeles and see what happens. You know?
Yeah, well, it depends, doesn't it? If, you know, I know what you mean, that getting rid of those regulations means that you have to rely on people's compassion and their responsibility, their sense of responsibility. So that could work, but it could go the other way, couldn't it? It could just mean that everything descends into chaos.
Maybe utter catastrophe.
On the people,
yeah. You know? Although I will say this, I have only been involved in one incident in the Santa Barbara area. I was in the a one-way street, two lanes, one way. I was in the left lane, and we were coming up on an intersection, and I wasn't turning. I was going straight. The car in the right lane, to my right, decided he wanted to make a left and careened right into the side of the front end of my car, which made it next to impossible to steer. That's how bad it was. And I was able to actually get it over to the side, to the curb, and so forth. But what my point is, with the number of vehicles on the road every day across this country alone, all right, the number of vehicles in morning rush hour traffic, you would think with all of the lack of responsibility on the part of many drivers, or lack of conscious awareness of where they are, what they're doing, because they're distracted by their phone, their kids, they're doing their nails, they're doing whatever, they're eating. You would think we would have more accidents than we do. And I think the percentage is very small by comparison to the volume of cars. So I'd have to say that, you know what? I would say there's a higher power involved here somehow, some way, that's keeping things flowing. Because haven't you ever had the experience, Steve, where you've been driving and you get to your destination going, I don't know how I got here. I mean, you were conscious of leaving the starting point, but you don't recall the trip until you got to your destination. You've had that happen, haven't you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's quite uncanny, isn't it, when it happens?
Yeah.
You think, how the heck did I get here? But it is almost as if there is a kind of conscious awareness which takes over. You know, you're free to think about other things or maybe listen to music. But something takes over. It's almost like consciousness takes over for you and drives on your behalf.
Yeah. Science is conducting all kinds of unique and actually kind of fun tests to support spiritual concepts and principles. One of them that I participated in back in my 20s with a woman by the name of, I believe it was a Virginia Benderly. And what she would do, this was just one of the exercises. She placed a photograph inside a manila envelope and sealed it. Then she gave it to each one of us. And you put it down on the table in front of you, and you could put your hands on it, but she preferred, if you would, to have your hands just above the envelope, scanning and moving your hands around. Now, what you were doing was not necessarily trying to get a sensation through your hands, but what you were trying to do was get an awareness of what that photograph was in your mind. Okay?
Mm.
I know there's a name for this, and I can't remember what it is. I'm thinking psychometry, but I'm not sure if that's the right term. And I was actually pretty good at it. I usually could. That you were always told, go with your first impression. Don't think about it. Go with your first impression. Another element for me is I see letters and numbers in colors.
All right.
And I believe
synesthesia.
That's the word. Yes.
Yeah.
They're doing studies with people in this country. I know that in Russia they were doing this during the Cold War. They were doing all kinds of psychic experiments, telepathy experiments.
Mm.
And according to one of my guests not too long ago, the level of accuracy in some of these kinds of experiments where you're to guess the card, what's on the opposite side of the card that's being held up, it's gone up over the years from 25%. Now it's up to 32%.
Yeah. I write about that in my book because, you know, I think the evidence for these phenomena is now indisputable. You know, there's so much really hard empirical evidence for them that an open-minded person cannot dispute it anymore. You know, you have to accept it, the evidence for telepathy, precognition and similar phenomena, because it's there. You know, it's. I mean, one of the things is that nowadays scientific experiments on telepathy or precognition are conducted with so much, you know, rigorousness, so much rigor, under really, really kind of empirical conditions, because the researchers are aware that there will be so much controversy about them. They know that people are going to try and shoot them down and try to explain away their results. So they try as hard as they can to make sure that, you know, there are no loopholes. There's no question of any other explanation. So, yeah, they're amongst the most controlled experiments in science today.
You know, it's an interesting point you raise. You remember also reading about years ago, a group of scientists were conducting this one experiment. And they wanted to conduct this experiment a number of times, and hopefully they were going to get the same result. And the experiment was conducted exactly the same every time, but every single time they got a different result. And so they had to go back and figure out, okay, well, what changed? Well, at least initially in the circumference of, let's say, the structure, the building that they were conducting the experiment, they figured, well, gee, who was here for the first experiment? You know, okay, scientists 1, 2, 3, 4, and 7. Okay, what about the second time? 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 9. And so, in other words, it was like, it wasn't just the people that were changing, but what they were finding was that the people were changing the outcome of the experiment just by virtue of their either being there or not being there, or even by their frame of mind. They even went down to that level. Well, what can you remember what you were thinking about, or what you were going through? Maybe going through some upheaval, some trauma, some happiness, some this or that. And they were finding that individuals are impacting the results of scientific tests. But see, you take that to a broader perspective, and isn't it true that we impact the world around us?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a nice circularity there because we're back into the realm of quantum physics.
Here we go.
Yeah. we're never very far away from the realm. Well, we're always in the realm of quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
But in this interview, we started out by talking about quantum physics.
Yeah.
And one of the findings of quantum physics is that the observer always affects the experiment. You know, what you expect to happen always happens. And so there's always a sense in which consciousness is always affecting what seems to be out there. In a sense, consciousness is also out there in the world. So you can't separate the observer from the observed. And yeah, that's been a finding of a lot of psychic experiments. So there's a famous experiment where two skeptics did the same, I think it was a Ganzfeld experiment where they guessed the shapes on a card. And then two believers in psychic phenomena did the same test. And of course, the skeptics got a really significant negative result and the believers got a really significant positive result just because of their, you know, the influence of their mind, their mindset, their worldview somehow affected the outcome of the experiment.
Wow. Well, and then I'm sure that there are other experiments that have been done that show even more profoundly our connectedness in that, we affect one another directly as well as indirectly, like that the proverbial drop in a still pond that causes those ripples.
Yeah,
it's science is starting to prove a lot of this stuff to be actually valid. These are valid concepts in the spiritual world.
I was going to say that spirituality is always about interconnection. It's always about transcending separateness and experiencing your shared consciousness, the consciousness you share with other people. It's all about compassion as well, connecting with other people's beings and experiencing what they're going through. That's always been a big part of spirituality. And yeah, I think science is catching up with that. You know, science is beginning to show that the world is interconnected and we do share the same essence and we can, you know, tune into one another's thoughts and feelings because, as you say, interconnection is a basic principle of reality.
Talk to me a little bit, if you can, about the I'll call it the concept of death. I like to refer to it as transitioning, death and dying or transitioning. Transitioning has less of a negative connotation. It's not as negatively charged as death and dying.
No.
But what about the experiments that may have been done over the years and the stories that have been told by people who have had near-death experiences, who have had communication with their loved ones who have passed on, or like in my case, they're animals. I'm still waiting for that first contact from Makushla, but I know she's there. But talk to us a little bit about that in relationship to this whole concept of the spiritual world and how the scientific world is beginning to even validate that reality.
Yeah. Well, the topic of life after death, you know, that's one of the things which separates scientists from spiritual or religious people, because it's a kind of standard premise of the scientific worldview that there is no life after death. And, some of my colleagues at my university, they're amazed when I say that I'm open to the idea of life after death, and I believe there is some form of life after death. They think I've gone crazy, you know, and I should give up my job and become a spiritual teacher. But I think you know, and actually, I was a bit skeptical of life after death maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But then I began to look at the evidence for it, and I began to think about it more deeply. And I realized that the evidence actually does point to it. And also that philosophically, you know, it makes sense. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of ways in which it seems logical to believe in life after death. But the reason why most materialist scientists don't believe in it is because they believe that consciousness is produced by the brain. So obviously when the brain stops, when the body dies, the brain stops functioning, then consciousness stops as well, like a, you know, it's like a light being switched off. So there can't be any life after death from that perspective. But if you don't believe that consciousness is just produced by the brain, if you believe that there is a kind of fundamental spirit in the universe and that our own consciousness is a kind of channel of that spirit, then there's no reason why consciousness cannot continue once the brain ceases. And there is evidence for that perspective from near-death experiences. So in near-death experiences, there is no brain functioning for a certain period of time, but people still report awareness. They're still conscious during that time. And other evidence, I think there are actually, if you break it down, there are three parts of the evidence for life after death. The first one is the reports of mediums who are able to gain information, who are able to make contact with deceased people and glean information from them, which is later confirmed. And there've been quite a large number of scientific experiments with mediums, which have been very tightly controlled, very rigorously conducted, and they've had very significant positive results. And the second one is communication with deceased people. And that can happen when people have a deathbed vision, you know, when a person, or maybe when a person has died without them knowing very recently, that person may appear to them. For example, a friend of mine, she was lying in bed one night and she woke up and saw her grandmother at the bottom of the bed. And her grandmother lived about 100 miles away. So she said, "What are you doing here, Gran? How did you get here at this time?" But her grandmother didn't answer and then slowly faded away. And the next morning, she got a call saying her grandmother had died the previous night. So those experiences are not uncommon. And there are lots of other situations where people have contact with deceased individuals. And finally, the third one is reports on reincarnation. There have been a lot of well-documented cases of reincarnation. A lot of it is reports of children. Sometimes there are young children who report details of their previous lives, and some researchers have investigated those reports. They've taken children to the places that they described and done various tests with them. And so, yeah, if you put all these things together, then I think there is a lot of evidence for life after death.
Well, you know, what is so interesting, I was going to throw the monkey wrench in of reincarnation, but you did that just fine without me. And I always used to say to people, said, you know, the only way I'm going to believe in reincarnation is if a child is born with a rock that's carbon dated. It's got it in its little hand that's carbon dated going back maybe 100 or 1,000 years. Now, I've got maybe I do have a monkey wrench I can throw into the mix. Okay. What do you know about life between lives?
Life between lives? Not very much, really.
All right, well, I'll share real quickly with you. We've had a local practitioner here on the program, and I've actually had a session with him. He takes you into a hypnotic state that you are consciously aware of everything that's going on. And he takes you back to your last life. Your last life, right before, you know, which leads up to your death. And then, of course, there's this transition point between one lifetime and the next. Now, first of all, I want to say that the lifetime he took me to, I really liked. I would love to go back to it. It was really kind of nice, in spite of the fact that my barn burned down and I lost my crops in a storm. I ended up moving up into a cabin up in the mountains where, on my last day of life, I walked out of my cabin. I went out onto the porch, sat down into the rocker, put my feet up on the railing. I said, man, this has been a good life. And I left. Now, the between lives is where sometimes, and this is just the philosophy, this is the information that has been gleaned from a Dr. Newton and the Newton Institute, where all of this information comes from. It says that for a period of time, you might stay there on Earth, kind of checking over the loved ones, seeing how things are going and what have you. And then you'll go into the next realm, spiritual realm, if you will, or etheric, where you'll have an opportunity for a period of rest after that lifetime. Then begins the continuation of information, of education, and encouragement to reincarnate because of the things that you've learned that you can now share with that generation and the other generations that you will come in contact with in that new life. Right. And it was really fascinating. Now,
yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
What threw a twist for me was a book that I've been reading. I carry it with me almost everywhere I go. It was given to me on my 21st birthday by a dear friend of mine. And it's called The Impersonal Life by James Banner. It was written in the 30s. And it was channeled. And it's basically God talking to you. Now, there's a chapter in there about reincarnation. And basically, it says, you seem to think that by going through past life regressions, you're going to tap into those past lives that you've lived. But the reality is you haven't lived past lives. What you're tapping into are the lives that I have manifested through that I'm allowing you to connect with to learn lessons in your present existence as my manifestation, which I thought about that going, boy, that's going to shake everything up. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized the point of doing any kind of past life regression, or if in fact it's just lives we're tapping into that God, the creator, the force has manifest himself or herself or itself in, the point is still to learn lessons for this existence. So it doesn't change anything. It doesn't alter a darn thing. But I found that whole concept absolutely fascinating. And so I kind of put this to you. Are your thoughts, your research, your investigating showing that whether there is this space between lives, incarnations, or not, is that our consciousness that is, I'll use the term euphemistically, that is traveling from the first life to the middle to the next life? Is that our consciousness? Is that our spirit, our soul, our essence?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. Yeah, to be honest, I've not really investigated the question of life between lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly very interesting. And I think, I think there is this kind of fundamental spirit inside us, which is the essence of our being. That's kind of the deepest essence of our being. But I think we all develop an individual mind with a personality and an ego and an identity. And I think that comes about through the interaction of our fundamental spirit with our brains. So we all end up with this particular mind. We all share the same essence, but there's this kind of individual mind that we have, which is kind of more superficial and which kind of is on top of our basic essence. But once this mind comes into being, then it seems to continue. Because, I mean, there was a lot of evidence suggesting that in the afterlife realms, people continue to have the same personalities or similar personalities, the same kind of minds, the same kind of identities. So once it comes into existence, then it can continue in other lifetimes, maybe reincarnated in other forms as well. But it seems to be somehow, it seems to survive indefinitely.
Well, that is certainly the theory of much of what you find in the ancient wisdom teachings down through the millennium. And then, of course, there's also this aspect of what they call the Akashic records. There are no books containing this information. You have to, I guess, be trained in order to be able to go into those realms. You know, that people also, in addition to near death, also experience out-of-body experiences. And I'm thinking that that's maybe the mode of transportation to the Akashic Records, to that, shall we say, library. And I just got my Akashic Records library card renewed just yesterday. What are your thoughts about that piece of information? Is there has there been any scientific research into these other realms that consciousness can go to gather additional information to maybe help them in this life and lifetime?
Well, I think what it suggests is that time is an illusion. And I mean, going back to Einstein, that was one of Einstein's famous, findings of his research was that time is an illusion. And, in essence, it doesn't really exist. The past and the future are illusions. And in a sense, the past and the future are still present. Well, the future is already present and the past is still present. So I think in some way, everything which has ever happened in the universe and everything which has ever happened in your life, all of those events are still here somehow. They're still embedded into the fabric of the universe. So maybe that's what the Akashic Records are. And there are certain states of mind when we seem to slip outside linear time and we become able to re-experience the past. We become able to glimpse the future. And that's simply because it does, it's all in existence. It's all here now. And it's just the illusion of our normal state of minds, which imprisons us in this kind of limited present tense.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had a dear friend who passed away on the 12th of September 2018, a dear friend of mine, a human. And I trained him in broadcasting back in the late 80s, and we worked together for many years, and he ended up moving. We went through a lot of cathartic events together when he was living here. He was living in Phoenix as when I was also. And after his passing, I've sort of been taught and trained over the years through these programs, which, by the way, are my therapy, that this person isn't gone. They're still there and you can talk to them. So because of the impending transition of my companion, Makushla, I started talking to my friend Dennis. There's his name. I says, Dennis, we're going to be sending her your way, and I'd really like for you to look after her until we get there. And, of course, I'm just really kind of open to this stuff. So in my mind's ear, I'm hearing, okay, sure, no problem. But you've forgotten one thing. You're already here. It's just that your body hasn't, that part of you that is in the material world is, and I'm going, oh, that's right. I forgot. So I've always felt that time is a human construct. Only way that we measure it is with the sun rising and setting every day,
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of interesting cases of hypnotic regression. You probably heard about it when people they regress to previous lives.
Yeah,
and in some cases, they even speak in different languages
that they never were trained in this lifetime.
Yeah, there was one woman who was she was recorded in a hypnotic regression session, and it was found out that she was speaking in an obscure dialect of 17th century Spanish. They had to find an academic who was familiar with ancient Spanish or old Spanish to recognize it.
Wow.
And yeah, there were lots of really interesting cases about that. And on the one hand, they suggest the evidence of reincarnation. And they also suggest that, time, they could also be seen as suggesting that time is an illusion, that, in a sense, as we were saying before, it's all here now. It's all still present.
That's interesting because of the research and study. I find it fascinating because I had a dream many, many years ago, and this was even years after my grandmother on my mother's side passed away. And I'm going to dive into this area as well in terms of dreams. And, you talked earlier, you used the term precognition. And this is interesting because I was born legally blind. And I wasn't driving until the age of 38. I didn't get my license until then because at the age of 36, I received a lens implant that gave me sufficient vision to wear through the medical review program of the DMV. Boom, 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 boom. Well, in this dream, I'm driving on a multi-lane highway in a white van, and I'm passing this forest, and I take the off-ramp, and I go into this forest and come out the other side of the forest into this beautiful green meadow, blue skies. The sun is just about, I don't know, maybe 30 degrees up and in the sky. It's like mid-late morning. And I come upon this stone house with these arched windows. And I go in the front door, and who's inside but, well, my grandmother on my mother's side. Doesn't say a word. Look into her eyes, a little twinkle. She gives me a hug to say, everything's okay. Now, it was after that, in 1998, 98, 99, my parents gave me their vehicle. What do you think it was? It was a white van. And the next thing I know, we're driving all over the freeways of Phoenix. We even, I think we drove it once all the way to Santa Barbara, but I'm not sure. I eventually gave it to my sister, and she had it for a while. But, you know, it's like, wait a minute, I don't drive, you know, and yet here I am in this dream driving. What about this connection to, how do I put this? These kinds of events, I was going to say future, but when we're talking time, yeah, there is future, there's past, there's present. But if we set that aside, there is no past, present, future. Everything is now. What about our tapping into those kinds of things? And then I'm going to throw one other thing in there, and that is the concept of déjà vu.
Well, yeah, maybe déjà vu is a sense of a previous lifetime in which you've had a similar experience. I mean, maybe you've been here before because, yeah, maybe you have the feeling that you've been here before because in a previous lifetime you were there before. There's a theory about people, isn't there, that, you know, there are certain people you feel an instinctive connection to. You meet them once,
yeah.
You speak to them for maybe a few seconds, and suddenly you know that you have a close kinship with them.
Yeah,
there's this really immediate connection. And so there's a theory that maybe, you know, you knew these people in your previous life and therefore they're not unfamiliar to you.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, it's really, I've used those deja vu experiences. I even had a day, I was 7 years old, I had a day where every time I turned around, I've been here before. I thought I was going to go crazy. I really did. I thought I was going to go completely nuts. But what I have labeled them, or I've put them in this category, and I haven't had a lot of them, and it's okay because of this concept that I've come up with to explain it for myself. It is when I hit one of those moments where I say, oh, I've been here before, immediately my mind goes to, I've caught up with myself and I am where I'm supposed to be. Now, some would say, well, if you haven't had them in a long time, how can you be sure you're supposed to be where you're supposed to be? Well, because if I'm not having them, I don't need them. But sometimes I need them to reassure myself that I'm going in the right direction. And that's why I've often said of my life, my career, my relationships, despite the fact that I've been through one divorce and never again, I do believe that for the most part, I've been in the right place at the right time for the majority of my life. How about you?
Yeah, I feel similar, actually. Yeah, I feel that, yeah, there's a kind of pattern which has unfolded. And if I look back, I can recognize the pattern. Often at the time, I wasn't really aware of it because it's difficult to see when you're actually in it. But I always have this sense that if I allow my life to take its own shape, then it will take the right shape. And it's a question of not really, you know, not getting in the way. Often there's an impulse to try to sort of control your life and direct things.
Oh, yeah.
Which can be good to an extent, but if you do it too rigidly, then it can take you in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
So, it goes back to Taoism, I suppose, that we mentioned earlier. It's a sense of allowing the Tao to express itself through you, to just sort of latch onto the natural harmony of things. And allow that to form the pattern of your life.
extraordinary. This is great stuff, I have to tell you. Steve Taylor, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. I know that we've got to let you go to get to other things as well. Maybe some other scientific experiments you're conducting, and we don't know about them yet. But we probably but we probably will in your next book. And hopefully when that comes out, we'll have you back on the program to talk about it. But right now, we, of course, been talking about spiritual science, why science needs spirituality to make sense of the world. Steve Taylor is my guest. He's also the author of The Leap and a bunch of other books. Go to his website, Steve. And actually, I had it right there. There it is. It's actually StephenMTaylor.com. That's what I have here, StephenMTaylor.com. And he's got at least 10 books listed. I was also going to talk to you more, and we'll have to have you back to talk about some of the concepts in some of your other books. Back to Sanity. Oh, my God, We need that now more than ever before. But that's another subject for another time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. And anytime you want to come across the pond, we'd love to have you in studio here in Santa Barbara to continue this conversation, because this is, honestly, this is great stuff. I love talking about this.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard. It's been a very stimulating and fascinating conversation. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Again, a reminder to our listeners that you can go to StephenMTaylor.com. We'll be linked to his website. You can go to SoundCloud, iTunes, the radio shows page at RichardDugan.com to hear the interview, the whole interview. If you are only listening to the radio broadcast, then you're only getting a part of what we talked about. And I tell you what, we did go on, and I'm so glad for the extra time that you've given us here on the program. I have three final questions for you before we let you go. I may have asked these of you the last time you were on, and you may have sort of addressed them within the context of the interview, but I'm going to ask them directly. The first is, who is Steve Taylor?
Wow. That's an interesting question. He is a he's an expression of spirit, an expression of the fundamental consciousness in the universe in the form of a body and a mind.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
It's not really conscious. You know, I don't have any really conscious aims or ambitions. But again, I'm allowing something to express itself through me. And my feeling is that this is moving towards, I am making a contribution to the evolution of the human race.
Ooh, I like that. Please help us to evolve. Final question. What is your life's purpose?
Wow. Well, my life's purpose is to allow what is inside me or what is coming through me to express itself in as pure and as powerful way as possible. And if I think about it, that, you know, what is coming through me is, as I mentioned before, is working towards the end of, helping the human race to shift to a high level of consciousness.
Well, Steve Taylor, thank you again for joining us. This has just been an incredible time here, and I do look forward to having you back again. And just real quickly, do you have another book in the works, or is that waiting for 2019?
Well, I also write poetry. I published two books of poems. I mean, they're not really poems. I call them spiritual reflections or poetic spiritual reflections. Mm-hmm. So I've been writing quite a few of those over the last two or three years. So my next book is hopefully going to be a new collection of spiritual poetic reflections.
Well, very cool. Well, we'll look forward to that, and also look forward to having you back on the program again. And again, thank you for giving us so much time.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. You're very welcome. Yeah, hopefully I will see you again.
Absolutely. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.